The clock's running out on December deal drops at Lowe's, but there's still time to wrap up something they'll love. Shop great gifts under $50, like the DeWalt Elite Series 100-piece bit set. Plus, if you order by 2 p.m., you get same-day delivery by 8 p.m. Shop December deal drops while you can. Lowe's. We help, you save.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 15, Episode 10, The Physical Evidence. This week, Bob covered the physical evidence against Jody in the murder of Demario Lowes. We have a lot of listener questions this week, and Bob, Janet, and I are here to go through them all. However, before we get into that, we have some news that we need to address.
Yeah, most of you, by the time this episode comes out on Friday, I'm sure you would have heard by now, it will have been a week by the time this episode comes out, since the Maryland Supreme Court ruled that Adnan Syed's conviction is going to be reinstated, and it's been remanded back down to the lower court to essentially redo the hearing. I'm not going to get too deeply into it because there's, you know, obviously you guys know I'm not a lawyer. A better source to understand what's going on would be Colin Miller or Rabia, who can explain it, but it seemed, I did not read through the entire 180-page order that came out, so if you want to do that, go ahead. I read Colin Miller's blog about it, but essentially, none of this has to do anything to do with Adnan Syed's innocence or guilt. What happened was, after the state's attorney's office, Conviction Integrity Unit, did their investigation, presented it to the court, their findings, and said there was Brady violation, and they thought Adnan Syed's conviction should be overturned. At that hearing, Haman Lee's brother Young was not present. And as they started moving forward, an attorney, I think it was his attorney, had spoke up and said that he was not given enough notice and that he should be there and have the opportunity to speak. And at that point, the judge said, well, they gave him notice last week. We can have him zoom in. The lawyer said that Young was at work until whatever time, 3 o'clock. So he said, okay, then we'll go into recess until Young gets off of work. And then he can zoom in and he can make a statement. So he zoomed in. He made a statement. They proceeded forward and then they overturned the conviction. A week or two later, some DNA results came back that excluded Adnan as a contributor for the DNA on Hayes' shoes. And at that point, the prosecution completely threw out. So rather than the conviction had been overturned, at that point, they dropped the charges completely against Adnan. So that was about a year ago when that happened. Since then, the Attorney General's office, which there's a lot of political stuff going on there, because a lot of what Marilyn Mosby in her office was claiming were Brady violations were things that the Attorney General's office had withheld. So they were kind of the culprits of the Brady violation that she was talking about. So they got somehow involved with Hayes' brother Young and Young's attorney, and then a challenge was filed, I guess, by Young through his attorney, saying that the conviction shouldn't be overturned because they should have had the opportunity as a family member of the victim to speak at the hearing. They should be given ample notice. And so that was filed. That went all the way up to the Maryland Supreme Court. So that is what the ruling was about. I believe it was a 4-3 ruling. The ruling was that Young was not given enough time, a reasonable amount of time, to come speak at the hearing. And there's, you know, with victims' rights, the hearing needs to be redone. So all that's been ordered is that the hearing has to be redone. So the consequences of that, the conviction currently has been reinstated, but Adnan remains free, I believe, until after this hearing is redone down at the lower court. The hitches come in. I have concerns outside of Adnan's case on a broader spectrum. It seems like this was politically motivated. I don't know. This is, to me, this seems, again, I'm a non-attorney, but it seems like a pretty strange ruling. Because now that it's been, this is now precedent that has been set by the Maryland Supreme Court. So that means any case in Maryland that is coming up for a hearing based on a writ to overturn a conviction, now they're saying that the victim's rights have, because there was something weird about the wording that puts a lot of rights to what happens in that courtroom on the family of the victim. And that's going to slow down the procedures for everyone. And it's just, I don't understand it well enough to speak on it, because to me it seems crazy, because the victim's family saying what, how they feel about what's happening shouldn't be relevant to the actual evidence in the case. I'm not saying they shouldn't have the opportunity to speak. Of course they should. But to hold up, to keep somebody in prison because of a victim's family member has to have the right to speak. I fear that this is going to have much broader consequences for the innocence movement in general because of this. So that's the bigger concern for me. The other thing that I found odd, and I don't know how normal this is, I've never seen it, but that doesn't mean much. Again, not an attorney. The Supreme Court remanded it down to the lower court, but they assigned a different judge to it. And that's one of the things to me that seems a bit politically motivated, because generally when things like this, so for example, the West Memphis 3 case, right? So when the Arkansas Supreme Court overruled that judge's decision about the DNA testing, they remanded it back to that court, back to that judge. It's supposed to be a redo. But in this case, they're not letting the original judge rule on it a second time. They sent it to a different judge, which seems like, you know, the idea is they're hoping that a different judge, whoever this judge is they assigned it to, won't make the same ruling. The other part of this that gets complicated is Marilyn Mosby is no longer in office. Ivan Bates is. We don't know what Ivan Bates is going to do here. If it was still Marilyn Mosby and it was still the same judge, it's an easily predictable outcome. They just go back to court. They redo the hearing. Marilyn Mosby makes the same argument. This time, Young Lee gets to speak in person instead of through Zoom. And then the judge likely would make the same ruling. But now you have a different prosecutor, so we don't know if he's going to make the same argument. And you have a different judge, and you don't know if he'll accept whatever argument is made. So it seems like it's a tragic situation as far as I'm concerned. You all know my stance on the case. I firmly believe Adnan is innocent. I don't think there's any possibility. I think that if you listen to the reply brief series, and where we're just going through the evidence, it's very obvious, in my opinion, that Adnan Syed is innocent. And he is legitimately at risk here. If they go back to that court, if Ivan Bates says, no, I don't see it, I'm not going to file a motion to overturn the conviction, then that's it. Or if he does, and this judge says, I don't accept this, and leaves the conviction in place, then that sends Adnan back to prison to serve the life sentence.
I don't like this. I don't, the remanding it back and not allowing the same person to hear it is very strange to me. Again, like we've all said, I'm not an attorney. That just feels real weird. Until proven otherwise, I'm going to have faith in Ivan Bates. You know, he's been vocal in the past about believing in Adnan's innocence. He has been vocal. He is part of his platform. He said that he felt that Adnan should not be in prison. I know that it's totally possible for someone to do a 180, but on that count, I'm going to choose to be optimistic until I have reason not to be.
Yeah, I hope so. All we can do is wait and see what happens at this point. There's two different elements of this. There's what this means for Adnan, which I think is tragic. The fact that he even has the chance of going back to prison is awful. And then the other one is, like, I can't stress enough how much this precedent is a big deal. This is not, as far as I know, is not the case in any other state. This is like new case law in the United States. This has never been a thing before. And in this particular case, it's odd because he was given notice. You can say not enough notice. I don't believe, as far as I remember, I don't believe that Young or his attorney prior to the hearing said, can we push this back a week so I have time to get there? They got the notice and he just didn't show up. And then at the hearing said they wanted to be there and they didn't have time. But also, this was on the heels of coming off of the pandemic where defendants were testifying in their own trials on Zoom.
Right.
Like, being on Zoom was not an odd thing. And also, it's, to my knowledge, Hayes' family, in the 23 years of this case, has never participated in any of these appeals, any of these hearings, anything all along the way. I know when I was at Adnan's PCR hearing in 2016, there was a section that was roped off for the first few days that was for Haman Lee's family. Nobody showed up. So it's like all of a sudden in this one, they wanted to be there. They were there. Like, Young was there. He did speak. If anybody was listening to the live, I was listening to it. A bunch of us were. You heard, like, he gave his, he said his piece. He said what he wanted to say. And that was it. I don't understand how this is a thing and how that now, because of this ruling, every time somebody goes to court with a Brady violation that should have their conviction overturned, now something that factors into that is what the victim's family has to say. And this is not to say that the victim's family shouldn't have a voice, they shouldn't have something to say, but also the evidence is what the evidence is. If there's a Brady violation, then the conviction should be overturned. If there's a Brady violation and a family member says, well, I don't care if there's a Brady violation, I still want them in prison, that shouldn't play a role in this. It's a constitutional violation. So I don't know. We'll have to see how it shakes out. I would direct people to Rabia's, I think she did an Instagram live. I haven't seen it. So you might want to check that out to get information from her. Also, Colin Miller did a blog about it at The Evidence Prof, where he explained his feelings on it. Those are your better sources as far as from actual lawyers that know what's going on. To me, the whole situation just seems tragic, and I have real concerns. It seems to me the thing that scares me the most is that the majority of the judges, the ones that are the justices, the ones that put this order into effect, have insisted that a different judge rule on it. That concerns me. I don't understand why they would do that unless they have some inkling that this other judge won't rule in the same way that the first judge did. But time will tell. And I haven't heard it. And I'll look in the chat. I don't know if anybody has heard any kind of timeline when the hearing will be redone. I don't know when any of that's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't either. Oh, what a mess.
Yeah, it is a mess.
So that's really all we have to say about that. We will keep you guys up to date when we hear anything. But as for now, just keep fingers crossed and hope that justice is served here. It's. You know, this is, I just said we're done, but it's frustrating because, you know, Adnan's ordeal, look what he's been through so far. So in 2016, based on that hearing, his conviction was overturned based on the failure to properly cross-examine the cell phone expert. Then that was reinstated, not because of the merits of that argument, but because of technicality, because the reason that conviction was reinstated was because it wasn't argued in a previous appeal and it was considered time barred, so they weren't allowed to bring it up at that time. So then his conviction gets reinstated because of that. Now his conviction gets overturned based on another Brady violation and some DNA testing, and then that one gets reinstated again, this time, again, not because there wasn't a Brady violation, not because the DNA testing and them dropping the charges made any difference, because a family member of the victim who did speak at the hearing wasn't given enough notice to speak in person at the hearing. And so it's reinstated again. I mean, it's a ridiculous ordeal that Adnan is going through over this. And none of those circumstances were his convictions reinstated based on any actual evidence. They were all both of them were based on technicalities.
Yeah. I don't really have anything to add to that. I share all of your concerns. And, you know, I mean, I think we're saying it, but for anyone who has any doubt, this is not about not wanting rights for victims' families. This is not about thinking that Young is a bad person. Our concern is when you start to use the people involved as players on a chessboard, which is what it very much feels like, that's doing a tremendous disservice to everyone across the board. That's not victims' rights. That's just manipulating and using. And that's tragic.
Yeah. And I can even see the argument if he wasn't allowed to speak.
Right.
You know, but like he did. And when he was zoomed in, he didn't say, I would prefer to be there in person. I didn't want to do this. He just said, okay. When he got off work, he zoomed in and he said what he wanted to say. So it just, I don't know.
And I believe what he said included him saying, I really want them to have found the right person, whoever that is. And that's, I'm paraphrasing, but that was something that I remember we all talked about, was that he himself was like, I want to trust the process. And if, you know, the right person should be incarcerated for this. I don't know.
Yeah. I thought the words he said were pretty moving back at the time. You know, he had said that he, in a way, felt betrayed because he felt like the prosecution was on his side, but then followed up with exactly what you said, where he said, but if the wrong person is in prison, then I want the right person to be caught and I want justice to be served. So, I don't know. Well, like I said, we'll keep you updated. We need to get moving further to talk about our episode now, and there's not much more I can add to the conversation about Adnan's case.
Amazon Five Star Theater presents Real Customer Reviews, performed by Ed Helms. Tonight's review, Tactical Jacket. I was living a simple life. Didn't get out much. Then, I bought this jacket, and everything changed. Women came flocking to me from lands domestic and foreign. I bought a motorcycle. Started hanging out with drug dealers. But like rich ones. And we flew helicopters. I ended up taking down a communist regime with a band of rebels. On the 245-day sailboat voyage home, I was attacked by a shark. I knew it was the jacket he was after. I tossed it, giving up the jacket in exchange for my life. I'm alive today, but jacketless. We'll buy this jacket again soon. 5 stars. Amazon customer 69. Thank you for listening to Amazon 5-Star Theater. Looking for unforgettable gifts this holiday season, like a jacket that becomes your whole personality? Shop the perfect gift this holiday on Amazon.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Google Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there, because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
This episode, we went over the 3 elements of physical evidence. As we get deeper and deeper into all the different evidence that was used against Jody to convict them, what did you guys think of this one?
Another huge mess. Just another string of sleight of hand, frankly, bullshit. Just a bunch of, here's this thing. If we put it in front of you in this light, you know, say this particular thing about it, and we say these words that make you think about this part of it, then maybe you won't notice that none of this makes sense, or that this particular piece of evidence is not pertinent in any way, shape, or form to the murder that we are trying this person for. I mean, it just felt like another gobsmacking misuse of the system, of evidence, of arguments, all of it.
Yeah, and to me, it, like, the whole thing just feels like it's all sleight of hand. I had said several episodes ago that the primary focus of the trial was basically litigating the robbery. And this was the same thing. Like, they put all this evidence about the spray paint, but there was no evidence that there was any spray paint anywhere at the murder.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with the murder. You know, it had everything to do with the robbery. The whole premise was that the robbery was the reason for the murder. Zach, what did you think?
Well, staying on that, I don't really understand the whole spray paint thing, even if it is to try to tie. So they found a can of spray paint that they could hypothetically tie him to the robbery. Okay, I get that. But why continue to harp on the spray paint? Like, I don't understand the idea of just continuing to bring up the spray paint. Like,
I think it's because they didn't have anything else.
Right.
Like, it just seemed, you know, absolutely ridiculous to me.
Yeah, and that's like when I originally read through the transcripts, like, in their entirety, as I'm just reading the whole thing, like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Like, you guys are getting, you know, things broken down into what's hopefully consumable bits of the information, like, but like, when you read the whole thing and the transcripts are up in the on the website, you can read them. It's just, as you read through it, it's like, what are they, like, what is this nonsense?
Yeah.
About the spray paint. You know, the guy that tested the spray paint, when they collected the spray paint, where they found the spray paint, Jody's fetish about spray paint, was all because the gun used in the robbery was spray painted gold, and Jody had gold spray paint in their apartment. So that spray paint might have been the same spray paint that was used to spray the gun, and therefore Jody killed DeMario with a different gun?
Which, yeah, by the way, let's drop the charges against Jody for that robbery.
Right.
Like, yeah, are you kidding me?
Which is just gives you an idea of how, like, what a joke this whole thing was. Jody was actually part of that one, and they fucked it up.
Yeah.
Like Jody was part of that.
Right.
And they're like, turns out we got the wrong person here. Didn't they drop the charges? But then they convict Jody on the murder, which they weren't a part of.
So the biggest question I have coming away from this episode is the car. Did Jody have the car that night?
Now, yeah, we and had I don't some listener mean, questions about that too.
I get that he had a ride home, but it sounded like before he did not have that car at all. But now it sounds like he did not have the car over the day of the murder or the day of the robbery. So I guess I want some clarification on the car.
The car was available to Jody on the day of the murder. Like the car was fixed. The car was operational. The car was at the apartment. Jody had just gotten a ride to work.
Okay.
I think, and when I talked to Jody about it, they were trying to remember exactly how that shook out. But I think it had to do with Jody and Sherelle both working. They both worked at Bob Evans. And I think maybe they got off work at one place and then got dropped off. For whatever reason, Jody got dropped off at work that day. It wasn't because the car was being fixed. So that was kind of the narrative that kind of came out of it, was they were claiming that the car brakes were being fixed. They didn't have access to the car. That wasn't the case. The car was operational, working. It was at the house. Jody just got a ride to work that day and then got a ride home from Cornelius after work.
What was the car? I mean, was Sherelle using the car too? I mean, do we know if there's multiple people using this car? Or is it just Jody's?
Jody and Sherelle both used the car. They had two cars, but Sherelle described that car as their car. It was both of their cars. At one point, she even described it as her car, but Jody also described it as their car, as the one that Jody drives primarily. So they had two cars. There was one of the witnesses, and who knows with all these witnesses what was true, but somebody had said that Sherelle was driving that car earlier in the day while Jody was at work. So I don't know how all that shook out. But as far as the car is concerned, it wasn't that the car was, like, unavailable to Jody on the night of the murder. The car was just at their house on the night of the murder. Jody had gotten a ride to work and then got a ride home from Cornelius.
Okay. I mean, it doesn't really clear up any questions I have, but it's just still confusing to me, as the fact of the whole idea of the car. Because I was under the impression that it was gone up until this episode.
No, it wasn't. And also, Chris is asking in the chat if Bob Evans is a grocery store. No, Bob Evans is another. It's a breakfast restaurant.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Melanie, I know that you felt some confusion similar to what Zach was feeling about the car situation. I hope that seems a little more clear. Yeah, I think people just had trouble tracking the car conversation, and again, with this evidence and the conversations we've had around it, like, these things keep bubbling up in different episodes at different times for, in some cases, different reasons to put emphasis on different things. And so I understand people feeling like, okay, wait, I thought I heard this, in a previous episode about the car and then trying to kind of put the pieces back together. But I feel like...
And some of that might have been my fault from what I had read from... Because like the stories that are out there, I mentioned like the newspaper articles and stuff like that. Like everything was spun. This whole idea of Jody hiding the car. Like, again, that would like... When you actually read through the evidence and you read through the testimonies of everybody except McGinnis, including the other officer, Officer Applegate, that was Detective Applegate, that was there when they went to get the car, like this was, there was no conspiracy here. Jody, on their own free will, got a ride from their mom down to the police station and said, I heard you guys are looking for me. I want to give you a statement. Gave the statement. They go ask mom. Where's Jody's car? And she says, it's at my neighbor's house. Here's the address. That was it. Hmm. That was like, the car was never hidden. No one was ever hiding the car. That was just completely a narrative that was made up by McGinnis. That was not the case at all.
In the chat, Nick asks, what car did Sherelle take when she went out, when Jody went to bed that night?
I believe, I have to go back to the testimony. She might have ridden with Nadia in Nadia's car, or they might have taken Sherelle's car. I think Jody's car was at, either way, Jody's car was at the apartment that night when they left. But I think she rode with Nadia.
Okay. Zach, are you good? Do you want to, should we move on to some more listener questions?
Before we move too much further, yeah. Down here in the chat, Juliana was asking, she said, how did Jody get from work to their mom's house? They got from work to the mom's, to their mom's house in their car, in the Cadillac. So that was, and that was the whole confusing part about it too, was you read McKinney's report and he says that Sherelle said that she gave Jody a ride to Bob Evans the morning after the murder. But then we know that Jody had their own car. Jody has told me, it's in the police reports, that Jody had driven to Bob Evans, got the call from LaShawn, who said, hey, they're here looking for you, talking about this murder and a robbery. Jody left work in their car and drove to their mom's house. So then it kind of became, why is Sherelle lying about that? But then Sherelle goes to the station. She interviews McGinnis. And where McGinnis writes down what she said, because of course we don't have any recordings or transcripts, McGinnis says that Sherelle told them that Jody drove to work themselves in their Cadillac that morning, which is exactly what Jody said, which is exactly what happened. So now we're left wondering, did she tell McKinney that she gave Jody a ride and was lying? Or did McKinney lie in his report and say that she said that? Because again, in McGinnis's report, she says Jody drove themselves. Jody says they drove themselves. We know Jody had the car because then Jody left work at Bob Evans in their car and drove up to their mom's house.
Wow. Okay. Lynn says, didn't the defense attorney notice the lack of a chain of custody on the jacket? So we're talking about the jacket for a moment. Seems basic. Sorry, when was GSR no longer considered a reliable forensic science? So two kind of separate questions there.
Okay, and sorry, I'm going to jump back again because I'm just reading the chat as we go, and Tex had another question that wanted to know, did they ask Jody where the car was? Why'd they ask mom? That's a good question. According to the report on Jody's interview, there's no indication they ever asked Jody where the car was. So it doesn't say that Jody didn't tell him where it was, that Jody lied about where it was, that... It never says anything about them ever asking Jody where the car was. The only thing we have in the report was that they asked mom where the car was. So hopefully that answers your question, Tex, regarding the jacket and the GSR. So the jacket's a whole nother thing. So the only, like I said in the episode, it seems like, and they testified to the fact that the jacket was found in the back seat of Jody's car. But the only report we have from them getting the car was McKinney's report when they went up and they searched the car, and McKinney wrote that they seized the spray paint and the empty box of shotgun shells. That was it. It doesn't say anything about them seizing the jacket. So I don't know. The lawyer didn't bring up any issues about chain of custody. So my guess is probably in some crime scene photos that we don't have, they were probably shown at trial. There's probably photos of the jacket being in the backseat of the car. I don't know. So when I was saying like, when I kept saying like, apparently it was because I don't see the documentation of where that coat came from. I only see McGinnis testifying to the fact that they found the car in the back, or the jacket in the backseat of the car. There's no, that I've seen, chain of custody that shows where they collected it, where they seized it, where they booked it in the property. Go ahead, Zach.
Well, since we're on the coat,
and the whole GSR and that whole idea. Is it normal for a detective to process evidence? I mean, that seems way out of left field for me to not have an evidence tech or somebody that knows what they're doing process a piece of evidence like that.
I don't know what normal means. I thought it was weird when I was reading through it that McGinnis gets this like kit.
Oof.
And then calls up and has them walk him through doing the test. The problem is we know all of the dishonest things that the police did in this case already. So I think we all look at this suspect. I'm trying not to do that because my first thoughts were, as soon as I read it, was, of course he didn't send the jacket. Because if he just sent the jacket, then you know, who knows what happened. But if, say, they wanted to plant GSR, then they could do it themselves. I'm not saying that happened. My guess is probably it was GSR on the jacket, because Jody has told us that they fired a gun just a couple days before that. The person that asked the question also asked, like, when was GSR gunshot residue considered to be not a reliable science? I did some research on this, and there have been cases where it has been challenged. There have been a lot of cases. The problem is what they're actually testing for is they're testing for certain particles that are present and usually in primers, the primers from bullets when they fire. But also some of the things like barium, lead, things like that are also present in things like fireworks. They're also present in things like brake pads. There's a lot of different ways for those exact same particles to end up somewhere. So to say that because these particles are present, that means it's absolutely because someone fired a gun is not entirely accurate. But it's not like considered junk science. Like, I read an article published by the FBI last year about it, that it is still reliable. They're getting better and better at, you know, now, 23 years later, they're getting better and better at identifying these different particles. But still, at the end of the day, it does not mean that a gun was fired. There, besides the things that they mentioned, you know, the things that I just mentioned, and then also that were mentioned in the testimony in the report, were that, you know, you could handle a gun that was recently fired. You could handle ammunition. You could touch somebody else that had recently fired. There's a lot of ways for those particles. You could be within 3 feet of somebody else that was firing a gun. There's a lot of different ways. So the discovery of gunshot residue particles on a piece of clothing like that doesn't necessarily mean that person fired a gun. That being said, wouldn't surprise me a bit if that's exactly what it's from, because like I said, Jody did fire a gun just a couple days before this. So that's probably what it is.
On a jacket that almost certainly was not the jacket seen at the murder.
Oh, yeah. I hope there's some questions about the jacket. Have you seen the side-by-side comparison that
it's
I put
insane.
Up on? Yeah. The idea, if you haven't seen it yet, go on to Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or wherever. I posted it all over the place. The side-by-side. First of all, the pictures that McGinnis was going to show Juwan James, where they, and it says in the report, they intentionally put it, and they made black and white photos, and they put it in a dimly lit room to try to identify it. And again, in McGinnis's report, just like all the other ones, he says that Juwan James told him there were some kind of designs on the sleeves, in which, if you look at the picture, you can see why McGinnis would want him to maybe say that, because they're still not designs, but the sleeves of the jacket the upper half of them are all, they appear white in the black and white photo. I think they're actually white and maize or yellow, both, but they're bright. But then we heard when we actually get Juwan James' own words, when he testifies, he says it was a black jacket with a gray stripe. If you look at the picture of the back of that Michigan jacket, and you think you're seeing in any way you could possibly, under any circumstances, describe that as a black jacket with a gray stripe, you're out of your mind.
Yeah.
There's no way that is the jacket they saw, which wouldn't matter except for the argument they were making was that the gunshot residue on that jacket mattered because Jody was wearing that jacket when they murdered DeMario. So like this is where the whole thing crumbles apart, right? So you have to like connect all these dots in order to make their case. Here's a jacket with gunshot residue that was in Jody's car. So Jody was wearing that jacket when Jody killed DeMario. And then you have this guy that saw the jacket of the person that killed DeMario, and that wasn't the jacket. So what are we saying here? So in all reality, you have to say that Jody killed DeMario, but was wearing a different jacket. in which case the gunshot residue on that jacket is meaningless, or the gunshot residue on that jacket came from something, like nothing actually right. connects. It's no. all smoke and mirrors. Nothing actually connects to this murder.
It kind of reminds me of like, we think we saw, we saw Van's footprints and someone had a pair of Vans. Not that pair. But yeah, someone but had a pair of Vans. Ooh.
Exactly.
Ugh. You know, we haven't talked, correct me if I'm wrong. We haven't spent really much time talking about Jody's testimony, like the very existence of it, like Jody right. being asked things in court. Are we going to talk more about that in a yes. future episode? Okay.
Yeah. So I think somebody had asked a question like, you know, we've referenced Jody's testimony, but we haven't published the testimony yet. The reason for that, some of the testimonies that we've referenced that you haven't seen published yet, Dwan James is another good example. It's because for a particular subject in an episode, we're using a piece of the testimony, but we haven't covered all of it yet, and we have plans to cover all of it in a future episode. So I'm going to do an episode where we go through all of Jody's testimony, everything they said from start to finish, and then we'll put out Jody's testimony for that instead of just a couple little clips that you've heard here and there.
Gotcha. Yeah, I know that was a question of Joni, but for me, it's just, we're just so not used to hearing from the accused, you know, for very yeah. specific reasons that
well, the problem here is Jody felt like they didn't have a choice.
Sure.
They didn't feel like their lawyer was not doing a good, like their lawyer,
totally.
According to Jody, Ernie White is turning to them through the whole trial, asking who this person is.
Oh my God.
We heard from, you know, when they were playing the tape during McGinnis's testimony during the 911 tape that based on what Ernie White was saying, he had never heard the tape before trial. Mm. And so I think Jody felt like their only chance
yeah.
was to get on the stand and try to explain some of this stuff.
Yeah. It's like being trapped in a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
There another chain of custody question, this time about the time card. There just says Joni has some confusion about, like, did Jody have it in their possession and turn it over to the attorney? Do you have a sense of the time card itself and whether or not?
Yeah. So the time card, the police had it and it's removed from the murder book that McGinnis gave to me, but it was in the copy of the murder book in the prosecutor's file. So it was originally in the murder book and it was given to the prosecutor. The prosecutor definitely had it. Jody got it. I think it was during when Jody was still locked up for the robbery. I think they said they had a family member that was able to get a hold of some of the police files from the investigation at that point. They got them from the police. So Jody had a copy of the time card. Then, and I think he had gone over that, or they had gone over that with their attorney. And then their attorney left the case right before trial, and they got a new attorney. And Jody was trying to get their attorney to do something with it, tried to give it to their attorney, but their attorney never came to the jail and spoke with them before the trial. Like they met in person, according to Jody, they met their attorney in person at trial.
Oh, that's
the first
awful.
Time they had spoken to.
Oh, it's chilling.
But so there is a chain of custody with the timesheet that it went from the police to the prosecutor, but then Jody also had a copy of it. But then the question is, was the time card turned over to Jody's attorney from discovery from the prosecutor? That's the part we don't know about.
Gotcha. Janiyah, I just want to acknowledge your question. I didn't get to it or your comment more when we were talking about the jacket, but also, you know, and you've said, Bob, that it's very possible that it was GSR and that it was from Jody firing a gun. But again, just Janiyah circling back to this idea of the defense attorney just not chomping down on the amount of people who wore the jacket, all the different ways that it could have gotten on there, just seeing a real lack of any sort of like attack happening on these flimsy pieces of non-evidence.
Yeah, I mean, Jody's attorney did a bad job, I think, of... There's another big incident that's going to come up in Sunday's episode that's coming this Sunday where a huge opportunity was missed. Yeah, it just felt like all the cross-examinations when you read the testimonies, it's like you see... Generally, when you read through these trial transcripts, you see this big, you know, direct examination for a prosecution's witness. And then the defense attorney, usually the initial cross-examination is like twice as long as the direct. And then comes the redirect and recross and all that. In this case, it's like every cross-examination, White seems to ask three or four questions. They don't really land any punches. And then that's it. And then usually there's a short redirect and then no further questions. That's the end of it. Like all these testimonies, you find they're 20 pages, 15 pages, you know, where normally you're looking at 150 pages for some of these testimonies. Mm. But Caroline Dwyer, who's been doing a bunch of research on the case, and not just this case, but like other cases in Bering County, said that apparently White at that time defended about 90% of the people in Bering County.
Oh, God.
As a public defender, was very, very, very busy, which, you know, you could see it. You could see it.
It's insane.
You know, and I never want to disparage public defenders. They're doing, you know, very important work. But also, it's just, and it's not that they're not good attorneys. It's just they're overloaded. When you have 150 cases you're handling at one time,
sure,
it's hard to put the attention that you really need to be put into any of the cases that they're working.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, thanks for clarifying that.
Amazon Five Star Theater presents Real Customer Reviews, performed by Ed Helms. Tonight's review, Tactical Jacket. I was living a simple life. Didn't get out much. Then, I bought this jacket, and everything changed. Women came flocking to me from lands domestic and foreign. I bought a motorcycle. Started hanging out with drug dealers. But like rich ones. And we flew helicopters. I ended up taking down a communist regime with a band of rebels. On the 245-day sailboat voyage home, I was attacked by a shark. I knew it was the jacket he was after. I tossed it, giving up the jacket in exchange for my life. I'm alive today, but jacketless. We'll buy this jacket again soon. 5 stars. Amazon customer 69. Thank you for listening to Amazon 5-Star Theater. Looking for unforgettable gifts this holiday season, like a jacket that becomes your whole personality? Shop the perfect gift this holiday on Amazon.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Google Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
There were also questions about, I mean, a lot of people really confused about the GSR. Janine, I know you had a question about how the test was done. I think we've kind of walked through in the episode and in the follow-up how little we know other than the kit. And
well, we know a little bit because I think the question was, or somebody's question was it a presumptive test or did they do actual particle analysis?
Right. And we know it wasn't sent off for chemical analysis because he did
it. Was.
Oh, it was. Yeah, after he did the initial test?
So what McGinnis did was the collection. So there's like these like swabs. They're almost like glue on them. And they like dab the jacket that collects particles off the jacket. And that's what I meant. Like we have to assume that that part was done honestly by McGinnis. But so
why do we assume that?
If you assume that, right? That was testified to was that he gets this kit that has these, I think there were 6 of them, maybe 4 of them, I don't remember. But there's like these little dab things that are like kind of like glue. They're sticky. Mm-hmm. And then they tap them all over the sleeve and then seal them up and they do it in a few different places. And then so that was the collection of any particles that were on the jacket. And then he packaged those and mailed them off to a lab for testing. That was Joseph Morris, I think, was the guy that did the actual testing on it. The part that I found suspicious was, why not just send the jacket? Like, why are you saying, oh, I got this? I mean, and I'm not saying this happened, but you could just grab your service weapon and dab your service weapon and send it and say this was off the jacket, right?
Sure.
Like, who knows? There's no, like there's no checks and balances, and this is not a guy that I trust to do things right, but whatever. But this is the process they say happened. So McGinnis did that and collected the particles on these dabs, put it together, shipped it off to the lab, and then the lab did. So there's presumptive tests that just that will react to a whole host of different chemicals that they can say is, you know, presumptive test is positive for a gunshot residue. That's not what was done here. Here they used an electron microscope, and they looked at the actual particles in an electron microscope to determine what they were. Like, there's lead and there's barium and there's all these different things. It's a real complicated explanation. In the, you can read it in the trial testimony. It's Joseph Morris's trial testimony on our website, where he goes through exactly what he did. But essentially, there's like a whole bunch of these particles that are like lead-based particles that could kind of come from anything.
Right.
There was a couple of the particles that were specific to gunpowder. And then that's why I said, based on those, that means that they were either, you know, the person either shot a gun, was near a gun, held a gun that had recently been fired, held ammunition that had recently been fired, all of that stuff that had come out. So that was the process.
Gotcha. Two kind of weird questions. When we're talking about gold paint, is it metallic gold or like sunflower gold?
I don't know.
I feel like it was metallic gold, but I don't know what I'm basing that on.
Yeah, I always assumed it was metallic gold.
Because it's car paint.
Yeah, Jody said it was exterior car paint, but yeah, I'm not sure about that.
And then, does anyone know if Detective McKinney has a sister named Lena McKinney? Maybe someone is good with the genealogy. If yes, I have an interesting connection to point out. Oh, that's a real to be continued.
I don't know, but we'll look further into that and find out if there is a connection there.
Well, speaking of the gold paint, Emmett says, in reference to the supposition that Jody had a fetish for spray painting things gold, do you think the prosecutor would have used the same bizarre language if Jody was straight and cisgender? That jumped out to me. It also jumped out to me, Emmett, as potentially trying to evoke a discriminatory reaction in the jury, which would have been totally legal at the time. And then Emmett says, happy to weigh in as Truth and Justice unofficial trans expert, LOL. that stood out to me as well. I think fetish is a very loaded word.
I don't think at the time that Jody was presenting to the jury, to anybody as trans or non-binary, anything like that. I think that the jury was looking at just a man sitting there. I don't know that any of that. So I don't think that plays into anything.
God, I wonder if it was just unconscious because they still knew, like, if they had that information, it just feels loaded, but
it could be. It felt loaded, but I mean, the whole thing was ridiculous.
Well, sure.
Like, they kept asking other witnesses, like, really likes to paint stuff gold, doesn't he? They're like, no.
Why are we still, yeah.
And this is important because somebody at the crime scene saw, nobody saw anything gold at the crime scene, but this is also very important.
It's like they're trying to turn Jody into a Bond villain. Like, and isn't it true that Jody is known for painting things gold after committing a heinous crime?
Yeah, it's insane. And truthfully,
Golden Bandit. That's right, Caroline.
I think I mentioned this a while ago, but like somebody, one of our usual trolls, had said something about how this is the most obvious. This person is more obviously guilty than anyone we've ever covered before. And the thing is, I enjoy those comments because things like that cause me to like step back and check myself. Right?
Sure.
Like, am I getting biased? Am I like, let me look, and I just go through it again. And that is the most ridiculous fucking statement I have ever. Like, sure, if you believe they're guilty, fine, whatever you want to believe. But obviously guilty, give me a break. This is insane. This case is nuts, and every single element of it crumbles apart. Like I said, the jacket. Just look at the jacket. Let's just look at the jacket again. We have a witness that saw the person pulling the trigger, shooting Mario. Saw them with the light right there, the porch light, wearing a black jacket with a gray stripe. And so how did the police then connect Jody to that? Well, in Jody's car, they had a blue and white and yellow Michigan starter jacket that had gunshot residue on it that in no way, shape, or form looks anything like the jacket that DeJuan James was describing, but it had GSR on it. Like, make that make sense. Try to connect those dots. You know, and then you have, obviously, the linchpin was Sonia Lucas. She's already said, nope, that was a lie. Victoria's testimony, I can tell you, is a lie. One of them's a lie. She's told so many different versions of the story. It's completely different. Like, and then the spray paint, that doesn't even connect to the case. It has nothing to do with the case. Hid the car behind the barn? No, they didn't. They just had the car parked there and told them where it was. Like to say that this person is obviously guilty is the most intellectually dishonest statement I think I could even think of.
Well, Tex says, I think the innocence isn't obvious, but neither is the guilt. And Tex is a person who feels that Jody admitting to being at the robbery made them wonder, are they saying I'm guilty of the murder, but they didn't prove that either. I mean, that's still a sticking point for some people. The moment that you revealed that Jody said, yeah, I was there, has thrown some folks, I guess.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that if somebody thinks Jody's guilty or wonders it and don't see the innocence argument, like that's why we're here, right? That's why we have this huge group and collection of people with from all different walks of life and all different perspectives to look at this. We don't want just a bunch of yes people, right? We want people to look at it from every direction. I don't have a problem with that. It's the idea of saying that Jody's obviously guilty that's a joke.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think if you want to simplify it even further, just show us the actual real evidence. Like, show us
right.
That this was done fairly. And then okay, but if you can't even, you know, it just doesn't matter. Like, I can't, whether or not Jody's guilty, I can't even bother getting there because everything in front of me, I'm tripping and falling over into this abyss of bullshit. I can't even get to that point. I can't see it.
Yeah, I'm having a real hard time getting past the timesheet that they didn't leave till 12:05 and the guy testifying that they gave him a ride home and sat there and talked to him for 30 minutes and they went inside, had an argument with the girlfriend, then went to bed.
Ugh, all yikes.
After the, like, while the murder is happening.
Oh,
like,
my goodness. That's
hard to get past. I'm also, like, I'm wanting to spit out more, but I'm in the rare situation where I already have this week's episode done.
Uh-huh.
So I have rolling in my brain what you guys are about to hear on Sunday that you haven't heard yet. So I have to remember to restrain that, but
so
there's more coming Sunday. Go ahead, Zach.
Well, I think that the argument to a lot of that is the same argument we have with police officers is can those statements be manipulated? Can that card be manipulated? You know, we're seeing things with police officers that we believe are manipulated, and I do believe they're manipulated, but I think that's what the other side is saying as well, is could those statements be manipulated? So that's where
I'm at. Yeah, and that's understandable, but that for me, and believe me, I know that there are folks that want to say that I'm just biased and I'm trying to spin things, but in reality, what I do with stuff like that is try to verify it. I have a timesheet says Jody didn't get off to 12:05, so I went to the person that was working with him. What happened that night? I don't remember the times, but I know I didn't get back till like 10 o'clock. Jody still had a pile of dishes to do, and I brought another giant pile, and I know we worked real late. And then we had a couple beers afterwards, and then Cornelius took him home. Then I see Cornelius saying, yeah, we worked late, and then I took Jody home, and then we stood around talking for 20 minutes before I left. And then we go to Princella, because it noted that she was there. And says, yeah, I remember, I came from the bar, I was pissed off, the lights were on. I came in, like, everything, so, in order to believe, as some people want to, that timesheet was manipulated and they didn't actually clock out at 12:05. Like, think of the hoops you have to, not you, Zach, but like in general, a person like has to jump through to get there. So LaShawn, who has no connection to Jody, other than at the time was him. Now they were working for him at the time. You have to assume that he's wrong or lying. You have to assume Cornelius was wrong or lying. And keep in mind, the police went to LaShawn hours later,
right,
and that's why it's burned into his memory, because he said no. That, and then there was also discussion that it didn't come out in the podcast, but it's in both interviews with LaShawn and with Princella, was that the next day LaShawn told Princella the police are here looking for Jody for shooting somebody, and she said, fire his ass, get him out of here, we're a new business, we're starting up, we don't need someone who's out shooting people working here. And LaShawn calmed her down and said, no, he couldn't have done it. I know I'm saying that's what he said at that time.
Understood.
LaShawn said he couldn't have done it we were here till like, you know, they said like 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning. Like, there's no way that we're here. Like, that, it wasn't like they were like old friends of Jody's and they were like trying to, the reason that they're there advocating for Jody now is because they know Jody's innocent. But you have to believe that Princella is wrong or lying. LaShawn's wrong or lying. Sherelle is wrong or lying. Cornelius is wrong or lying. Kenya is wrong or lying. Like, you have to assume all of that in order to believe that the actual evidence, which is a timesheet that says Jody left work at 12:05, is not accurate. You know, so like, it's something to think about. But for the people that and I say want it not to be true, because the reality of it is, I think we can all agree, it has to be not true. Right? For Jody to have any connection whatsoever with this, even if the crime happened at 12:40, that time can't be right. It cannot be right that Jody clocked out at 12:05, Cornelius drove them all the way home, they stood there talking, went inside, argued with Sherelle, go to bed, and then somehow make it back. And like, none of that can be true. So you have to, in order to believe that Jody is obviously guilty, you have to believe that that timesheet is not right. And in order to believe that, you have to think five other people with no allegiance to Jody all were wrong or lying. All of them. That's a lot of mental gymnastics to jump through to try to make something so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure, you know, if there were a bunch of documents that should have been in the file, that would be easier to tell about all of this. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. those are mysteriously absent. Yeah. So that's a problem.
This is, never, ever. And between the cases we've covered on the podcast and the dozens of cases that we've screened and investigated outside of the podcast, I have never seen a case where we don't know when 911 was called.
Yeah.
We don't know. There's not a single document in the entire file that verifies what time police were dispatched to the scene. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
That is the kind of useless information that a former chief would look at and say, I'm going to shred a few documents here and there. This doesn't seem important. I guess I'll shred this. Not the whole file. Just some extra loose paper.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're so concerned with being streamlined. The only question I have left is a question that Courtney asks about Duane, which is just, is there anything that indicates whether Duane is or is not a credible witness from what you've come across?
You're going to hear all of Duane's testimony in this week's episode. So that's a nice little tie-in to what's coming up on Sunday.
Let's pretend it was on purpose.
Yeah. And you have to judge for yourself. This is what I look at from Duane. Duane had nothing to gain. So we have all the witnesses. You have people that are in jail that are trying to make a deal that are also, you know, John Bradshaw, we heard from. You're going to hear from more of them this week that, you know, tell stories that are provably false, but they're in jail. They're trying to make a deal. So you can see their motivation for that. You've got guys like Beetlejuice. Remember him, Tommy Travis?
Yeah.
Tommy Travis, it literally says in McGinnis's report that when he went around offering reward money, all of a sudden this guy comes up and says that he's got a story. And then not a single human being verified his story. In fact, everybody said he was not there that night at all. And then you have the entire Miles family. And I'm not saying they're lying, but Carvale Miles was a suspect in this murder. A lot of people thought Carvale Miles was involved in this murder. So then you have Victoria Miles statements, Glenda Miles statements, all those, you can see if they're not telling the truth, that there's, you can see some motivation there for why they would be.
Yeah.
The
Miles family is all over this damn case.
Everywhere. Yeah. Even the direction to Duane James came from from Dora Miles. But when it comes to Duane James, he did not come looking for reward money, did not want to talk to the police. They had to track him down. And finally, and even in the report, it says reluctantly, he finally told me what he saw, is what McGinnis's report said. And then he described something that sounds reasonable. He didn't describe something that sounds unreasonable. He didn't describe something that's easily disproven. Just says that he was there. He saw the shooter. He was directly across the street. It was verified that he did live there at the time. He didn't live there anymore, but he lived there at the time. Saw the shooting. So I don't see a motivation for. And then when they tried to get Duane to come in and identify the jacket, he never showed up to even do it. He didn't want nothing to do with this. So it's hard to imagine And his testimony didn't like point the finger at any particular person or point it away from any particular person. He gave just what just seemed like very basic facts of what he saw. I don't see any reason not to believe that testimony. That's what I can say. And that's the honest to God truth. That is how, again, despite what people might think about biases, that's how I look at every witness. Is the story provably false? Does it make sense? Does it correspond with what other people are saying? And do they have a motivation to lie? And I don't see any of those factors there with DeJuan James. So it's up to you to decide if you believe him or not. I don't see a reason not to.
All right. Well, I guess we'll have that chance next week.
Yep. Just in 2 days after this airs on Sunday. Make sure you tune into that. And we'll talk to you guys next week on the Friday follow-up.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue, the $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets.
It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary, not valid for McDelivery.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Google Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.